This is the Improve Photography Podcast, episode number 84. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improve Photography Podcast. I'm glad you're here. Thank you for the download. Today, you are joined by thousands of photographers from all around the world, from Iceland, where I'm heading in a couple weeks with some of the listeners of the website, to humble old Caldwell, Idaho, where I am right now. And I am joined by my good friend and co-host, Darren Meller.
And you were also joined by a bunch of photographers here near Omaha, Nebraska. So how you doing, Jim?
I am doing well. It has been iPhone 6 week, and I have spent tons of time reviewing that, got that up on the website, and now I'm preparing for some other shoots coming up in the next couple weeks that I'm really excited for.
Awesome. I have some shoots down the pipe, and I have some people ready to book with me, and they've just been seeing my work, and I love the organic marketing and posting just those meaningful photos on my Facebook feed and talking with other people. It's amazing. Once it starts to spread like wildfire, people are starting to call you left and right.
You were telling me before we hit record about a couple of the interesting things you were doing for marketing with the school and also a word of mouth referral. Tell me how you're getting business.
Well, it was a great idea. Actually, you mentioned it to me, how fundraisers, when kids go out and sell magazines and whatnot, the school doesn't get very much money. They get about $10 to $15, according to my high school counselor, per student who has to hustle and sell about 400 magazine subscriptions to get that amount of money. So I sat down with my high school counselor, and the band director wasn't there because it is homecoming week here tomorrow. But we're going to have another meeting, and I suggested doing some packages. We're going to do a Saturday shoot where we set up four different locations at our local Glenwood Lake Park, and we're going to have the students go through there with my dad and I, two photographers. It's going to be $150, and we give the school back $15 per shoot with that. And we also offer more intimate private sessions at two different price points. One is $469 and the other is about $999. That's a very, very big package. The $499 is a great package. It's a great value, but it's kind of bare bones compared to the other one. But I give back $50 on the $499 package and $100 back to the school on the $999 package. And that is going to be great. She was so excited to hear that because the school can make money for different departments like the art department that's struggling, the band department. And that's why it was a great idea when you passed it along to me, Jim. So I'm so grateful for that. And for as far as looking at word of mouth marketing, you just do a good shot, a good shoot. You make it a great interaction with the family that you're working with or the couple. And guess what? They're probably going to tell at least one or two friends, and one or two friends are going to come across the situation where they're like, I'm looking at my photos on my wall and through my albums. They're outdated. Let's give Darren a call.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. We've been talking about that school idea, and I had mentioned on the podcast a long time ago, but I still haven't seen people do it. So I'm really excited to see how it works for you. I just think it's just going to kick butt because schools are just dying for money. And every time I see these kids coming by, you know, selling entertainment books and candles and stuff, they just make so little money on it. And then high school seniors, all of them, the whole senior class is going out to hire a photographer. And so how about go to the band, go to the choir, go to the football team, go to everybody, all the organizations, talk to the choir director and say, hey, I can give you $50 for each one of your seniors that you come and get a senior shoot through me. And still, you make a pretty nice margin. If you charge $450 for the shoot and you give them $50, that still leaves $400. And usually a senior portrait shoot is pretty straightforward. I mean, you're going to have to order a couple prints and some things, but you're going to be making at least $100 an hour while you're doing that. It's not bad at all to do that. And also, I like the idea of kind of doing the mass senior portrait Saturday, like you're saying. You know, it's just $50. It's quick and dirty. But if you can get 30 seniors to come in there and give you $50 and you're only spending 25 minutes with each, you're doing okay, you know, and you're helping out the school, you're giving back, and so it's very cool. One thing to talk about to your accountant is if you can write off what you give back to the school as a charitable contribution. Check on it. It's definitely, you know, advertising, but, you know, you can slip it in as a charitable contribution, so very cool. Anyway, so some exciting things you're doing. I love to see you trying out different stuff. But today we got a ton of listener questions, and we want to take just a few and talk about them now. So let's go to the first question about displaying your photos.
Hi, my name is Joseph Land, and my photo website is najonephoto.com. That's NIZHONI. And my question is about displays. So I edit my photos on a laptop, kind of against my will. I have no other choice. And I have recently started using Pro DPI to print my images. And I have found that even though I'm using a calibrated monitor and I'm adding just a hint of brightness to all my photos before I send them to the printer, I'm finding that my photos are still consistently coming back underexposed from Pro DPI. So I've troubleshot this with them, and what they've told me is that since I'm using a laptop, I have to recalibrate my monitor every time I open it. So what I'm considering doing is purchasing a display because I figured maybe the results will be more uniform if I do that. So I was wondering if you could recommend a display, or if maybe you could confirm or disprove this idea that I have to calibrate my laptop each time I open it. So if you could just recommend a display, I would really appreciate that. Thank you.
This is a good question because a lot of photographers are using a laptop to edit with because in a lot of ways, desktops are kind of going by the wayside. More and more people are just using a laptop for your computer. For me, I still like having a nice workstation to work from, because I spend a lot of time at the computer. But if I didn't, I was just using my laptop just for family stuff after the day is over, then yeah, I could see that. Anyway, I don't think you need to. Well, you certainly generally don't have to calibrate a display every single time you print a photo. That you don't need to do that most of the time. But all laptops work differently, and some laptops may do a really bad job of keeping colors and brightnesses. If that's the case, then yeah, Pro DPI is right. Then you can only that's maybe just your only option is to just constantly recalibrate to make sure it's exactly right. What I would think is far more likely as being the problem is that you're seeing other things in the room and it's affecting the brightness level. So if you are editing and it's dark outside, there's no light coming through the windows, and it's a dim room even if you have the lights on, then yeah, it's going to look very, very different than when it's noon, you have the windows open and you're in the room. Or even if you're just against a white wall one time and then the next time you're, sitting on the bed and it's pretty dark in the room. Things change in the environment and you would be surprised how much that affects how you edit the photo. So that's what I'm going to go to first, is it's probably just the environment around you. But could it be the display? Yes, that's possible. So troubleshoot that first. If you've got to get a monitor, then there are so many good options right now. The one that I really like is the Monoprice monitor. Is that what you're using, Darren?
I'm just using the 27-inch iMac IPS display, but
Oh,
I've heard
that's
great
right.
things about that. Yep.
Oh, that's who it was. It was Jeff Harmon, who we talked to a couple weeks ago on the podcast, is using that, and he really likes it. It's the exact same panel as in the IMAX. It's just a lot cheaper. So, check a Monoprice monitor and you should be just fine. If you're not going to do that, you don't want it that big or you don't want to spend that much money, I would just look at anything that Dell makes. Dell makes really good, inexpensive monitors that are usually very high quality.
Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth. I was saying Dell in my head right before you said it, and they do make high quality monitors. And if I was on the PC side of things or even wanted to hook one up to my Mac if it was possible, I would use a Dell because they do have a great reputation.
Yeah, and another one that I can personally recommend is the ViewSonic brand. They're very inexpensive, like $150. Go check on Amazon and search for ViewSonic and make sure it's an IPS display. And if you get a ViewSonic IPS display, I can personally tell you those are nice displays. They're not high end, they're very cheap, like $150. But they will keep your colors correct. My beef against it is that they just don't have enough pixels. Even 1080p right now is a small screen. It's just not as high resolution. And for doing photography, I really like having a big high resolution screen. But if you're on a budget, that's a good option for you as well.
It's a great option. I've been a fan of ViewSonic even when they were making the old CR2 monitors, and they've always been an inexpensive option. So it just depending on your budget, it's going to depend on which direction you'll go with it.
All right, now if you're looking for something new to look at on your monitor, let's go to the next question about Facebook pictures.
Hi, Jim. It's Krista from Charlotte, North Carolina. I have a question about color spaces when exporting photos from Lightroom. I'm just wondering what to use when exporting for Facebook pictures. Pictures are just going to be posted on Facebook, and then what to use when you're exporting photos to be printed or posted on a website. Thanks.
All right, Darren, how do you export your photos for different social media sites?
To be honest, I'm probably doing it wrong, but I export it in the highest quality because Facebook has a notorious problem with just making my photos look bad. I can post it on Facebook, and for instance, if I do anything with the Illumience or the HSL panel in Lightroom, or adjust my vibrance to make the sky a little bit bluer, it always gives these weird JPEG streaks across the sky. It's almost like it's catching each level of light. And I go back to Lightroom and it looks perfect, but as soon as I post it on Facebook, it kind of just kills the quality to a lot of respects. And so, I mean, what I've been doing lately is I've been dropping my quality down to 50% quality in Lightroom just because I'm not seeing the benefit of 100% quality just because Facebook strips metadata and it just kills my image quality and my personal observation.
You're right. Facebook does a terrible job with photos. About a year ago, I think it was, they made a big improvement. Before that, the photos just looked horrendous. Now they're, not as horrendous as they used to be, but it's still not nearly as good as a lot of how a lot of other sites display pictures. And in Facebook's defense, there's a reason for this. You're getting on Facebook on your phone, you're on slow cell connections, people are updating it many, many, many times a day. Facebook has to be really careful with bandwidth because we're using so much of it. But the photos do look bad. And so I, like you, I've tried every trick in the book to make the Facebook photos look as best as they can. And I've tried uploading it to the exact size that Facebook uses. I've tried different color spaces. I've tried, pings and JPEGs and all kinds of different things, different quality settings. And when it comes right down to it does not matter. Facebook is going to take your picture and they're going to do with it what they do with it. And so it really isn't going to make a big difference for Facebook. So I do the same thing as you, Darren. I usually just make my quality about 90% in Lightroom just to save a little bit on the upload time. Because really, the difference between 90% and 100% is like microscopic. It's almost impossible to tell the difference between the two. So I just set it to 90 to make the upload a little bit quicker, and then I'll export it at full resolution, and then Facebook will do with it what it does to it, churn it and poop it out on the website. Now it's different though. She also asked about, she said, for Facebook and then for putting on a website. If you're putting it on your own website, like you're doing the HTML or you're doing this in WordPress and it's a part of WordPress that isn't going to resize it for you, then it's extremely important that you pay very close attention. In that situation, I usually keep my quality setting around 70%. And I will set the resolution to the exact pixel width and height that I want on the website. So for example, if I make an HTML website and I upload an image that's 20 megapixels on there, it's gonna cover your whole screen plus some. Like how when you used to open up an email attachment and it would just be huge when the browser wouldn't handle that for you. That's what it's gonna look like, because it's doing exactly what the photo says in that situation. But if you're putting it on something like Squarespace, on SmugMug, something like that, they're going to handle it for you. They're going to resize it. So you might as well just give them the full resolution and let them take care of it. They're going to size it down to multiple different sizes so that when somebody gets on a phone, they'll get the perfect size for them. That's not too big of a picture and fits the screen just right, just the right quality. Somebody goes on a tablet, desktop, big desktop, whatever it is, they're going to get it the right size.
Perfect. And I do it this a similar way in Photoshop. I use Photoshop's Save for Web option, and you can also control the pixels and try to maintain as much quality. And it's a little bit more in-depth process than Lightroom, which is why I like exporting from Lightroom more. But say for web with Photoshop is cool because you can also make sure that it's under a certain amount of kilobytes if you're not using something like SmugMug, Squarespace, or you know a more high-end WordPress plugin that does the resizing for you depending on the format it's being displayed on.
Excellent point. And I do the same thing. I never export a photo from Lightroom that's going onto my website in the HTML way, just because you don't have as much control. I always go it over to Photoshop or take it over to Photoshop to the save for web. And I have found that the percentage of quality in Lightroom, like if you set a quality to 70% in Lightroom and 70% in Photoshop, you get very different results. The Lightroom at 70% is still a pretty big file. If you go to Photoshop, go to Save for Web at 70%, you're getting a much lower quality, much more compressed file. And so that Save for Web dialogue is pretty nice.
It is.
All right, let's go to the next question about taking pictures in dark shade.
Hi, my name is Anne Hong. I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And my question is about doing photographs in deep shade in forests. I was in an old growth forest, and I didn't have a tripod with me. I was shooting handheld. And I found that the pictures I was taking originally were very dark. And I forgot about ISO at that moment. And I increased the aperture to wide open. I wound up getting, a pretty shallow depth of field for a forest shot, and where I wanted to get more of a view of the whole landscape or the whole forest. And then what I wound up doing was increasing the exposure compensation on my camera, and the pictures I got back were pretty washed out. The shadows were kind of grayish. There just wasn't too much punch or pop to the images. So I was thinking next time I probably would need to increase the ISO in that situation. It's pretty dark shade in the old growth forest. But wondering your thoughts of any other ways that may help get the rich colors while still being in the depth of the area, what I'm seeing while still being in a deeper shade situation. Of course, next time I could bring a tripod as well. All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. What tips do you have for shooting in dark shade, Darren?
In dark shade, I bring a reflector usually. If there's any light that's coming in, I usually will pick the white side of the reflector. There's actually a lesson that you and Dustin did that looked like it was the Capitol building in Boise. And if I use a reflector, sometimes if I want it to be really powerful, I will break down and use the gold and silver side of a 5-in-1 reflector that you can see under Jim's recommended gear. But the white side seems to add a little bit extra light in there. And otherwise, if that's not going to cut the mustard, I will also bring in some speed lights and fill lights to help the situation.
That's exactly what I was thinking. So she's looking for the right camera settings. The problem that I understood as she was describing it isn't so much a camera setting problem, it's a dynamic range problem. And that's exactly what you were talking about, Darren. You're looking at ways that how can we add light to the person so that it matches the amount of light in the background. And then we're not going to have to worry about a washed out background or a dark foreground because it's going to be about the same exposure level. So if I were to just, you've just thrown me in this forest with this lady and you're like, all right, Jim, what camera settings do you pick? It's going to depend on how much depth of field and stuff you want. I'm probably going to pick something pretty wide open if we're shooting a portrait, and something probably closed down if we want a lot more depth of field. She wanted something with more depth of field, so maybe I'll pick something like f16. And then for my shutter speed, I'm in aperture priority, so the camera's going to pick it for me. And then I'm going to leave my ISO at 100. The rule of thumb is never touch your ISO until you can't get enough light with the aperture and shutter. It's not that cameras haven't improved a lot and that we can't use quite a bit of ISO, but if we don't need it, we might as well not use it because we'll get very slightly cleaner pictures. So that's what I'm going to do to start out. And then if I need to add light to the foreground, to a person, to a tree stump, whatever's in the foreground, then I'm going to, use a reflector, use a flash, whatever we need to use. But the real key is your camera settings nothing you can do in your camera settings is going to increase your dynamic range. It kind of is what it is. And so we have to use flash or reflector some way to put more light in the shady areas. The real way to fix this is to shoot more of these landscape pictures earlier in the morning or later in the evening. During the day, when there's a huge dynamic range between shadow and highlights in a forest, it's going to be really, really tough to get professional results.
It is. And also, using higher ISO, and I can't say this enough, that it kills sharpness a lot in a lot of photos. Like, I've seen some amazing photos come across from our students at photoclasses.com, and they'll show us some great photos, and I look at it, and I'm just like, darn, the ISO was clear up to 1,000. It just killed the sharpness. It would have been a perfect photo, and no matter how much masking or luminance noise reduction you do, the sharpness is killed. So I think that sticking with ISO 100, unless you have to bump it up, is a great rule of thumb.
Yeah, and that's actually something interesting as well that a lot of photographers, even more advanced photographers, don't recognize, is what I said just a second ago, that there's nothing you can do in your camera to increase the dynamic range, you know, in the camera, just with the camera settings itself. But there is a way to decrease your dynamic range, and that is by increasing your ISO. As your ISO goes up, we all know that your noise goes up. But what we don't often realize is that your sharpness goes down because we have less detail. That noise is kind of making things look a little bit mushy in the details. It's covering up details, and so it looks a little bit less sharp. And your dynamic range is always lessened, sometimes severely, as you increase your ISO.
And have you noticed, I shoot both crop sensor and full frame, it appears that my 70D does not handle noise as well as my full frame. And I've noticed that phenomenon with other students that shoot similar cameras, both on the Nikon set and the Canon side of things. So have you come across that with the crop sensor?
I definitely have with individual crop sensor cameras. You know, the Nikon D7100 isn't even close to doing as well in low light as the Nikon D810, for example. But they're very different calibers of cameras at the same time. Now, can a crop sensor do as well? I really do believe so. And I'm anxious to see what the 70D Mark II does in low light. I think the issue is that often the crop sensor cameras, it's not that so much the sensor format that can't handle it, it's just the camera manufacturers are putting less quality of sensors in those crop sensor cameras. So can it be done? I really do believe so. I think it hasn't been an area of focus because they're working more on budget on those crop sensor cameras, which I think is kind of unfortunate.
It is.
All right, let's talk about street photography in daylight.
Hi, Jim. Jonathan from Stuart, Florida. And my question was, do you have any tips for street photography? And what I really want to know is, what modes are the best for shooting in daylight or a very overcast day? Thank you.
All right, you just got back from Italy or from Europe. You must have done a lot of street photography. How would you generally set up your camera for that?
I found myself, especially when you have cloudy days in Northern Europe, because Southern Europe, it's very, very bright, and you can shoot with a very, very small aperture and not shoot wide open. You have to shoot with very fast shutter speeds, especially if you're shooting in hours of the day at noon, if you decided to sleep in and miss the golden hour in the morning and have to wait until the golden hour in the evening. But on the cloudier days, I would slow my shutter speed down. I would also open my aperture up to use a, depending on how much depth of field I wanted, and I would have to lean against buildings as well just to make sure I was sturdy if I didn't feel like carrying my tripod around that day. But as far as street photography goes, I would say it's similar to almost shooting in a forest in some situations, because when you're in Europe, there's all these tall buildings and these very tight streets, and sunlight has a hard time of making their way through to what you're shooting. So you're just going to have to meter the light correctly with your camera and just hope for the best and take some test shots and be patient with it.
I think that's right. If I were doing street photography, I would definitely shoot on aperture priority mode, because so much of it is capturing a particular moment, something that just happened, you know, as the sun's setting, we get just a second of fleeting light coming through. And so I would definitely shoot in aperture priority where it can adjust the camera settings for you.
Yes, Aperture Priority, I used to stick away from it, but it's so much more convenient sometimes than shooting a full manual, because you might need to bump up your ISO, which is a last resort, but you also might need to mess around with shutter speed and then mess around with your aperture. And if you're an Aperture Priority and you know you want to shoot at f/16, it's sometimes good to let the camera do the thinking on what's going to produce the best exposure for you.
Very good. Well, we have a couple more questions that we want to get to. Before we do that, we want to take a minute and thank Squarespace. Squarespace is the sponsor of the Improved Photography Podcast, and we really thank them for our support. I have been working with Squarespace quite a bit, and I have my site ready to go, ready for you to look at. It is at photographyidaho.com. So what I like about Squarespace that didn't work as well when I tried a couple other options for my website is that it really is my website. I get photographyidaho.com. It looks like it. They don't bolt on their logo anywhere here. It's all my branding, all how I want it to look, and it's just on the back end run by Squarespace. Nobody would ever know it. It's incredibly easy to set up. It looks good. The pictures load fast. It's just, I really am enjoying it a lot.
And if you're on the go and uploading things, and I'm still on the fence and I still haven't jumped over to Squarespace yet just for time constraints, but now that I found about this new app they have, it's the Metrics app. So it's a great app for those who are on the go. It's only available for iPhone so far, and they're working on it for Android. But you can take a look at your analytics, and you can look at your key performance. And it's amazing how you can just use things on the go, because using the WordPress thing that I use and other things, there's just no substitute for having to go home and sit down and work on your computer. If you can do it on the go, why not?
Yeah, it's very cool, especially when you're traveling. Well, to start a trial with no credit card required, you can start building your website today. When you do decide to sign up for Squarespace, don't forget to use our offer code IMPROVE. IMPROVE is the offer code, and so just go to squarespace.com and use that offer code. I forgot when I signed up for mine. I didn't even get the 10% off. Well, we thank Squarespace for their support of the Improved Photography. Squarespace, a better web starts with your website. I really wish I would have remembered that. All right, let's go to the next question about switching from Lightroom to Photoshop.
Hey, Jim, it's Fred in San Antonio. I have a Lightroom/Photoshop round trip question for you. So here's the thing. I edit a photo in Lightroom and then do further edits in Photoshop using the copy with Lightroom adjustments option. When I'm finished in Photoshop edits and return to Lightroom, the exposure's been changed. And I assume I have something set incorrectly. Can you tell me why the exposure is being automatically changed when it's returned to Lightroom? If it matters, the photo is... it's usually lighter after I do the return trip, and it's driving me nuts. Thanks for your help. Keep the tips coming, man. Thanks.
This one's a little bit, I'm a little bit stumped on this one. The exposure really shouldn't change when going from Photoshop and then back to Lightroom. It definitely should be the same. The only couple things that I can think of are if, maybe when it's being imported, if you're hitting the auto button so that it's adding automatic settings in Lightroom to adjust for the contrast. You know, if you had a really dark picture, you know, it was intentionally dark, a real, really moody picture. And then if you click on that auto button when you're importing in Lightroom, then it's going to change the settings. It's going to say, well, it's too dark, and it won't know that you did that on purpose, and it could change it. But that's only if you're doing an import. If you're just saving in Photoshop and going to Lightroom, I'm a little bit stumped, I've got to admit. You have any ideas on that one, Darren?
I'm stumped as well, and I have a different round-tripping approach, and it might not be the best approach because it might scare some photographers out there. So let's say I'm working on a photo in Lightroom. I'll do my adjustments, my basic ones, and if I find a limitation that I need to go over and pass it to Photoshop, I'll do my work in Photoshop. I'll merge my layers together, and I will hit Command-Q on Mac or Alt-F4 on PC to try to quit the program, and I'll hit Save. And in my experience, when I hit save, it just tosses the photo back to Lightroom as a TIFF file. And as we've said in the past, it's the closest thing to a RAW file. So if you still aren't satisfied with it and you just want to do some other minor tweaks back in Lightroom again, you have this beautiful TIFF file that has a lot of information, almost similar to a NEF file on your Nikon system or a CR2 file on Canon.
Yeah, I don't know. This one is really... a little bit of a stumper. I'd love to sit down at the computer with you and kind of see exactly what's happening. I've got to think just something weird is being clicked. But I've never seen this problem, and I haven't heard of any photographers having this issue. So I don't know. I'm not quite sure where to point you. I guess maybe one more thing that you could check is if it is some kind of bug, then you may check about writing your changes to XML. So in Lightroom, if in your preferences, if you have set how I recommend it, go to Lightroom Preferences, catalog settings, and then there's a box that says also apply changes to XMP. And if you click that little box, and I do recommend having that on, I'm wondering if something's happening, like the Lightroom has those changes, and then we go into Photoshop, and then when we come back to Lightroom, the Lightroom grabs the XMP file, and that's messing it up. That's all I can think of, but it would be a bug. That should not be happening. But it might be at least something to try, is just unchecking that and see if it makes any difference. But again, I've never seen this, so I don't know. I don't know. I'm a little bit stumped on it.
Yeah, and I'm going through the preferences in Photoshop right now with file handling and whatnot, and I can't see anything on the Photoshop side. So I think the XMP file might be modifying it. And I'll go ahead and put it in the show notes of what Jim's referencing with the setting that is pretty crucial that he's recommended for almost over a year now. So yeah, it kind of has me stumped as well in what's really causing that beyond what you just explained.
Yeah, and while we're on that topic, the only situation where I don't recommend that setting is if your computer's already struggling with Lightroom to keep up, if it's just too slow. If you got a fast, modern machine, you should be just fine. I've never seen any difference on, off. It works just fine with my computer, but I have a faster computer, so something to check. But if anybody has seen this problem and has found how we can fix this, come to the show notes at improvephotography.com/84, and we'll check in the comments, right? Tell them what you found.
Yeah, that's the great thing about the Improve Photography community is we pick up so much more knowledge from our students and our listeners. My gosh, I can't thank them enough for all the information that they put on there. And they even keep us in check sometimes, and we might say something that might be a little inaccurate. We're humans, we make mistakes, and we really appreciate your constructive feedback.
Yeah, that's for sure. All right, let's go to the next question.
Hi, my name is Anne Hong. I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I apologize for the second message. I called and had a question. I realized I didn't say it as clearly as I had hoped, but I had been asking about photographing rock formations. The rock formations that I'm talking about are greater than 10 feet tall, and they're big enough you can climb over them. There's different passageways through them. And they're also in kind of a pretty shaded forest area, but every once in a while there's some light that comes through. So it winds up having areas of shade and pretty bright sunlight all on the same kind of blue-white rock with green moss growing on it. And I was wondering about exposure, color correction, color white balance, and then also composition ideas or thoughts. The pictures that I got back were, I had said in my previous message I wasn't very fond of them. The reason was they were very flat. So the colors were very flat. The composition just seemed very flat. You just didn't get a sense of the depth of the rocks and what was there, and also even the size of them. So thank you for humoring me with the second message, and I look forward to your thoughts. Thank you.
Great question, and it brings up something that I've actually been meaning to point out. There are two terms in photography that are very confusing. One has absolutely nothing to do with this question, and the other one does. But I want to talk about both just for the sake of talking about it. One is when we say the lighting is flat. I often hear from students and other people that talk with us about photography that they'll say, the lighting just looks really flat. And I'll look at the picture and it has too much dynamic range. It's really deep shadows and really bright highlights. And I say, well, that's not flat lighting. That's really crazy dynamic range lighting. That's the opposite of flat lighting. And so when we say that the lighting looks flat, usually what we're talking about is that there's not enough tonality in the photo. It's just all very even toned. And that's when we say the lighting's flat, that's usually what we're talking about. And so this situation, it's not so much that the lighting's flat, it's that, you know, it's all crazy all over the place. But I think when people say that, what they really mean is the lighting doesn't look good. The same thing actually happens in music. Often I hear people say, oh, whoa, you're singing kind of flat. And what they really means is, whoa, you're not hitting the right notes, buddy. So I guess just that as a side note. But to fix this problem is really, again, a dynamic range problem. The way that I would fix this is if we have crazy shadows and highlights going all over this rock, the best answer is find a cloudy day where the lighting's going to be more even, more flat. Or you could go earlier in the day, later in the evening when the sun's on the horizon, and then it's going to come at pretty much the same angle across everything. You know, it's not going to be hitting some places and making splotchy shadows. The shadows will be more even because the sun is further down on the horizon, coming at more of an angle to the rock. And also the lighting in the morning and the evening is usually more spread out, because the horizon itself kind of spreads that light along it and makes for a softer light source. So those are the two things I would do. This isn't something that you're going to fix with different camera settings. You know, if we have just splotchy lighting, we got to fix it with better lighting. There's nothing really we can do in camera to fix it. In terms of composition for rocks that you also asked about, you know, what I've learned about composition is learn those couple basic rules. And then you need to go out and just look at photo after photo after photo after photo after photo. So go to 500px, go to Pixoto and just search rock formation and see how people are placing rocks in the frame. And I bet you'll think of things much more interesting than if we were to just spout off different rules of composition. Often you're going to end with a pretty bland perspective, bland composition of the frame.
For sure. And there's some things you can do in post-production, but I think that shooting either on a cloudy day or right after sunrise or right before sunset is going to lead to the best results. And, you know, what you're saying with the rules of composition, it would just confuse things. And the best thing that I've always learned with composition is if you can just look at all those pictures and find out what story is being told with those other photographers' examples, you're going to learn how to tell your own story based on the context of these rocks you're trying to photograph. Just because when you were describing it, I could definitely hear the beauty, but it's just getting the story behind it to make the photo stand out to what you see it with your eyes.
Great point. Now, okay, my aside now that we've answered the question, I didn't want to get too off track at the time, but the other word that I hear photographers get all confused on is the word zoomed. I often hear the word zoom where the photographer really means telephoto. So somebody will ask me all the time, you know, when I'm on my son's football game, I'm coaching his little flag football team, which is like the highlight of my life. But all the time, parents will come to me and say, oh man, I need a lens with some zoom. And I'll look down at their lens and it's an 18-55. And I said, that is a zoom lens. And they're like, no, it's not. You know, everybody looks too far away. And I'll say, oh, you mean a telephoto lens. I understand. Zoom just means that you can change change the focal length in the picture. Telephoto means it's a long lens. I was having a hard time with this because I'm finally finishing up the lens finder. It's been a behemoth of a project. Just took a lot more time and effort than I had anticipated. Definitely the most ambitious project that I've ever done on the website, but we're getting close. Anyway, I was asking a question that I wanted to say, do you want a telephoto lens? And I realized, oh, this is going to confuse people. And I thought, okay, fine, I'll say it even though it's wrong. Do you want a lens that's zoomed in? But then I thought, oh, but that's just not right, because what if it's a prime? It doesn't. Anyway, it's zoom, folks. It's zoom.
All right. It's also funny because we don't even want to throw in the word super telephoto, because that's even talking about bigger glass and bigger lenses. So yeah, it is a confusing thing.
Yeah, it definitely can be. Well, in every episode, we want to share a doodad, a cool something, a resource, whatever whatever it is that we've found. Darren, what's your doodad for this week?
I'm going to go to something that was announced a little while ago, and it's definitely out of my price range and out of a lot of photographers' price range. But
it's something that you dream about as you lay down at night, right?
It is. It's almost like that Ferrari or that Lamborghini or that Bugatti as far as cars go, but it's the Hasselblad H5D200C, and this thing is a monster. It can shoot up to 200 megapixels, and they have finally included a CMOS sensor in it, so you're not restricted to shooting at ISO 100. It's just an amazing camera as far as some uses out there for having higher resolution images, but it creates 600 megabytes, 16-bit TIFF files. And my gosh, the way it does is it takes multiple shots at 50 megapixels and creates a 200 megapixel photo. And each pixel within there has a representation of red, green, and blue for RGB. So it gives you so much power in post-production. But they're estimating that its price is going to be roughly $40,000 to $50,000. And for a camera, my gosh, imagine what you can get without having to buy this camera. But I do dream about this at night. And sometimes I wake up and even think it's in my office and it's not there. And I'm pretty sad.
Yeah, it's like car lovers have, you know, Ferraris and stuff as their desktop background. And photo lovers have Hasselblads. It's like someday I might touch one. Very cool. Well, the doodad that I want to share with you this week is super cool. I was walking through the auto parts store, which never, ever happens. I can barely check my own oil, but I was looking for a part for my boat. Anyway, I was walking through AutoZone, and I saw this. It was like angels sang, and there was a hallelujah chorus going on in the background. And it's this LED light stick. It's probably about a meter long, so it's pretty long, and it has 120 daylight balanced LEDs with a battery in the grip of it that you can charge either, you know, to the wall or in a car with a car attachment. And so I saw it and I thought, that is awesome. It's exactly like the Westcott Ice Light. Just that it doesn't cost $400. It costs $40. And I've been using it on a couple shoots. It is so cool. It's really fun. You know, when I'm just shooting a quick portrait or something, I'll have the model just hold this above their head, you know, and you just cut the arm and the light out of the picture. And it just is such a unique type of lighting. I've been wanting to do a couple sports portraits of just headshots, you know, like the football player sweaty and grimy and stuff, and just use this because it's just such a weird style of light. It's just very unique. No speed light makes a light quality quite like this. So, you know, definitely don't use this as your primary light source. But for something just kind of cool, edgy, different, go buy yourself an AutoZone light stick. It is so cool. I love it. There are two sizes. One is $40, the long one that I got, and one is smaller. I think it was $20. It's quite a bit smaller, and I don't know. I kind of wish I got the small one. I might still go out and get it too, but these things are just so neat. When the Westcott Ice Light came out, what, a year and a half, 2 years ago, I saw it, and I thought, that's cool. I could see myself using it, you know, on a shoot here or there where I just want something kind of different, but there's no way I would pay $400 for that. And $40, it really does the same thing. It kind of gives you the same thing. One thing is that since it's not kind of a frosted lens on the outside, each LED, it's kind of a specular, makes a lot of specular highlights. And so one thing that I'm considering doing is getting just a piece of wax paper and taping it around the edge to kind of soften that light just a hair between the lights, because they are a little bit spread out. But, you know, if you're looking for something different, something kind of fun, go pick yourself up an AutoZone light stick. I'm going to check and see if there's something similar on Amazon, or if AutoZone's selling that on Amazon. And if so, we'll put that in the show notes. But very cool.
Yeah, and that's a great savings. I've noticed that a lot of photographers lately, they've been so ingenuitive with finding do-it-yourself projects for expensive lighting modifiers and things like that. And beyond the wax paper, you might want to try using just regular Scotch tape because it has about the same opacity. So that might be helpful too.
Oh, good idea.
Yeah.
Well, that does it for this episode. It was fun talking with you, Darren, and hearing questions from all of you that you've sent in. You can always send in your questions at improvephotography.com/podcast question. Sometimes it takes us quite a while to get to the questions, especially if we've had a similar question recently. Sometimes we'll even hang on to it for, you know, 4 or 5 months until it's kind of new again or we have a different idea to solve the problem, and then we'll toss it in. So fear not if you've submitted a question and hasn't come in. Sometimes we just have to kind of hold them until it's the right time for that particular question. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for the download. When we'll see you around improvephotography.com.
Bye-bye.